the budget title review and recommendations report and the adoption of the outstanding minutes. And the third item on the agenda is the briefing by the Department of on the two bills. One is on maritime and the other one is on transport laws. There are a few members that have apologized. Honorable Zelo is going to the doctor. He will be joining the meeting late. Honorable Kakose is sick. The doctor's appointment. Honorable Soka is taking a meeting of the route. He will be joining us late. Honorable Kronbrook will be going out to a local conference and then come back. And Honorable Onis will join us late. So because of that situation, we will start with the briefing with item number 3, the briefing. Can I hand over to the department?
Thanks, Honorable. We will be making a briefing to the Procurement Committee on the South African Maritime Search and Rescue Bill, amended Bill of 2012, which will be led by Advocate Masumuk.
Thanks, Chairperson. We are presenting before you the South African Maritime Aeronautical Search and Rescue Amendment Bill 2012. The background of the bill goes as follows. Before I proceed, Chairperson, we have circulated the hard copies and together with the bill as introduced, and at the back of the bill we've got the memo on the objects of the bill. So on your spare time you might also look at that. The background of the bill goes as follows. The South African Maritime Search and Rescue Organization, SASA, was established by the South African Maritime and Aeronautical Search and Rescue Act of 2002, Act No. 44 of 2002, as an authority responsible for the coordination of maritime and aeronautical search and rescue regions. The Act provides for the requisite legal framework for the provision of a search and rescue service in South Africa. The Act also incorporates the International Convention on Maritime Search and Rescue of 1976 and Annex 12 to the Convention on International Civil Aviation, 1944. The object of the bill, Chairperson, are as follows. To amend the South African Maritime and Aeronautical Search and Rescue Act 2002 and 44 of 2002, to insert certain definitions and to amend others, to expand membership of SASA, to empower SASA to perform its function in terms of international agreement outside the Republic's search and rescue region, to empower SASA to determine procedures to be followed in conducting meetings of the subcommittee of SASA, to explain how meetings of this committee should be held, to reweigh certain sections of the Act, to realign the sections of the Act and delete obsolete provisions, to amend the reference to the Aviation Act 1962 with the current reference of the latest Act, which is South African Civil Aviation Act 2009, the 18th of 2009, to compare license holders of aerodromes, airfields, heliports and helistops to file emergency plans with the Rescue Coordination Center, to expand the reporting centers where a person can report an aircraft or vessel that is in distress, to spell out the objectives of the Aeronautical Maritime Rescue Coordination Function, to expand the scope of the regulation making powers of the minister and to provide for matters connected therewith. Chairperson, this particular bill, there are no policy changes. It appears that when this principal act was drafted, the manner in which proofs were done in terms of proper sentencing and phrasing of sentencing leaves much to be desired. For instance, we are amending, when we say we are realigning, we find that the sentence says South African law, then we are changing it to read South African law so that it can be reader friendly. We are also making reference to the latest legislations, for instance, reference to the old repealed law, and we are making reference to the current law that has repealed the old law. The other thing that we are doing, Chairperson, we are explaining the procedures of committees of SASA and subcommittees of SASA. We are explaining as to how quorum should be constituted, who should chair the meeting of those subcommittees, and where are they supposed to be conducting these particular meetings, and who can convene the meetings. So we are also just realigning the air so that can be reader friendly. So in essence, that is the purpose of the bill. Chairperson, I will explain each and every clause as follows. The bill has 19 clauses, the salient features of which are as follows. Clause 1 is a standard provision that defines certain words and expressions. And in there, we are defining the word regulation. You can find it in the bill in Section 1. Clause 2 and 3 rephrase the wording of Section 2 and Section 4. That is where we are changing the word Africa into African law. Clause 4 amends Section 5 by explaining the membership of SASA and spell out the committees and subcommittees of SASA. SASA consisted of various departments and certain organizations. So we have added other departments which were not forming part of SASA committee. And we are also spelling out committees and subcommittees of SASA. Clause 5 empowers SASA to perform this function outside the Republic's search and rescue region in accordance with the conventions. Clause 6 provides for alternative persons to preside over executive committee meeting of SASA and also determine the procedure to be followed in subcommittee of SASA. This I've already explained. Clause 7 determines how meetings in the committee and subcommittee should be held. That is the procedure for the meetings. Clause 8, 9, and 10, and 11 is amended by realigning and rephrasing of the sections of the Act. Clause 12 deals with rephrasing of the words in the section and deleting obsolete provision. Clause 13 provides for the reference to the current legislation, that is the Civil Aviation Act of 2009, which has replaced the previous Civil Aviation Act. Clause 14 makes it compulsory for rescue plans to be filed with the rescue coordination centers and delete obsolete provisions. Clause 15 places a duty to a person who believes that an aircraft is in distress to report such incident. Clause 16 spells out the objectives of aeronautical and maritime coordination function. Clause 17 makes the duty on SASA to submit a report on its activities to the minister once a year. Clause 18 expands the scope of regulating making powers of the minister. Clause 19, Chairperson, here, I need to point it up front that Clause 19 is a consequential amendment. There is an error in this slide because our Clause 20 is the one that deals with short title and commencement. That is normally in every Act, the last section of the Act. So Clause 19 is a consequential amendment in the sense that there are two ways which are substituted by other ways. And wherever they appear in the principal act, they are to be substituted. For instance, the maritime committee is substituted with maritime subcommittee, and aeronautical committee is substituted for aeronautical subcommittee. So wherever they appear in the principal act, then they must be substituted with these particular two ways. So that is clause 19. And clause 20 is the short title and commencement. And that is the end of our presentation and the end of the amendments that we are proposing that the committee should consider. And after deliberation, we request that the committee approve this act. The consultation of this bill goes as follows. The bill was published for comments. Before the bill was published for comments, the bill was discussed and approved for public consultation by SASA committee members contemplated in Section 5 of the Principal Act. If we look at Clause 4 of the bill, we have listed the members of SASA, and we've also indicated which new membership have been added to those memberships that has been always been the membership of SASA. All those from A up until KL, these were existing members of SASA. Then we've added South African Water Services. So this bill has been discussed in the committee of SASA, which consists of all these members from A up until M, with the exclusion of the new members that have been added just in this particular amendment bill. So the bill was published also in the government gazette 33126 on the 23rd April 2010 under notice 538 of 2010. Upon publication of this bill, comments were received from the following two institutions. The South African Maritime Authority, SAMSA, the Air Traffic and Navigation Service of South Africa. Chairperson, it is not surprising that we receive these comments from these two institutions, because if you can see that all of these departments forms are members of the SASA, and they are the ones who have given a go-ahead that this piece can be published for comments. So even the comments by SAMHSA and HNS were not that substantive, because they are also forming part of this committee. And comments were received and incorporated in the bill. The bill was also presented to the JCPS cluster on the 8th May 2012 and the International Cooperation Trade and Security cluster on the 10th March 2012. And both clusters approved the bill to be introduced in Parliament. The bill was also presented to Cabinet, and Cabinet has also approved that this bill to be introduced in Parliament. And we request the Portfolio Committee to consider and approve the bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of clarity from members?
Chairperson, apologies for being late. I was told on the plane that the SAA technical division delayed the VA flight, so we arrived quite late at the airport. My apologies. Just a question to the department. It's a related matter to this bill, and that is the thing that we raised, I think it was last week or the week before. It's in terms of maritime search and rescue and towing of ships that get stranded. Have you given any thought to changing legislation with this bill to make provision for a fund to pay for the costs of towing a ship that is in distress, because we are, as government, having to foot the bill often, 180 million, I think, last year. And then the Auditor General flags us and says, well, it's unbudgeted expenditure, was irregular, whereas in fact, it's totally out of our control. It's something which is up to maintenance crews of ships and the weather and navigation systems and all sorts of things which we can't control. Have you given any thought to including proposals for that in this bill? Because we still, if we approve this bill without any amendments in that regard, then we are still going to end up having to fit that bill, and there's no legal framework for us to deal with that when we can't find the owner of the ship, when we can't find the insurance company, then government is stuck with the invoice for 10 million or 20 million or 100 million for that purpose. But you might have an answer. It might be that you're putting it in a different law or something. I don't know. I just want to know if you've considered it, and would you think of adding it to this bill, or should it be somewhere else? Thanks, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chairperson. This bill is not envisaging creating any fund that will be that will be its objective would be to finance the ships that are in distress. But we will raise that particular issue together with our maritime department and check as to whether what is in their plan about establishing that kind of a fund. Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Chair, if the Auditor General raises an issue with us regarding, you know, having funded that, was it not in the interest of SAMHSA, you know, to flag that issue with us, to say the Auditor General did raise this issue with us, and this is how we are proposing that the issue be addressed, because it will come, Chair, tomorrow again from the Auditor General to say, but I did flag, I did warn you about this thing, and you were doing an amendment, a about what I said to you about that. I thought that the chair of the department and SAMHSA would have, you know, raised the issue and not, you know, just pass it because it was not the
first. Can I get the response?
Thank you, Chair. Basically, what we are talking about here is the unforeseen and unexpected incidents. We discussed this at length with National Treasury, and National Treasury then decided that we will explore it further. However, the budget for the unforeseen incidents, as it is now, is very difficult to access. And I hear, I understand the question, the very same frustration that members are expressing, the frustration that the department has, but the National Treasury is taking the lead on this. So we are pushing that, and if there is something progress, we will definitely report on it. To make it to be part of legislation, I don't know. Maybe we'll discuss with the legal branch in the department to establish if it is possible for that to be done. Thank you.
Can I make a follow-up? Is that not a risk management type of a budget or a disaster management type of a budget? The only thing that you would not have known if you are putting a budget to cater for that is the type of the disaster that would happen. So I would disagree with the notion that says you can't budget for an unforeseen thing, because the fact that we are providing rescue services means that you can budget for that. That is the service that is being provided. What kind of a disaster would happen is what is not known. So it cannot be then that Treasurer would say, in my view, that you can't budget for an unforeseen, you can budget for a disaster to prevent disaster you budget for, to respond to a disaster you budget for. So I don't know how the department would fail to argue that point. Because we even have in this country a disaster management act.
Thank you, ma'am. So, when we discussed with National Treasury, they indicated that the budget is there for the unforeseen and unexpected incidents. The challenge we have as a department, which we experienced, was accessing that budget, basically. For instance, you would know about the Sailor shipwreck, which is just at yet Bloomberg's grant. We've been struggling to get funds to remove that wreck, because it has not been budgeted for, but this is like we will try and get something. I agree with your argument there.
Can I get clarity here? What do we mean by budget?
Chair, let me ask my colleague to come in and come with a response on this one.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. From SAMHSA's side, maybe to go back a little bit, search and rescue is linked to persons only. And so you're talking about distressed ships which are sit elsewhere. And there is a maritime fund, and as the DOT correctly say, Treasury has put funds into the financing of the fund. The difficulty we have on the operational side, as my colleague correctly says, is that the funds are there, you're providing a service, your service providers are starting to produce invoices, and for example, one of the instances we have where someone had to wait a year to be paid. And so the problem wasn't so much budgeting, but as Treasury says, the funds are available, but I think the process
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I don't really understand that the department is telling us. It's like a play to me. They are saying there is a budget for the unforeseen, but it's not easy to access it. What is that budget for if you cannot access it? Why do you come and tell us that? Can't you argue that and come with tangible reasons to us? You just say, we cannot access it. What is it that for? So that is why it is like I'm dreaming now to come and sit here listening from the department what you're saying to us. Thank you, Chairperson. I don't understand. Maybe I need more clarity.
Can I clarify before they respond? The department is saying we are as frustrated as the portfolio committee because we put the budget as the department and Samsung, and the budget gets approved. But then when we need to use that money now, to pay the service provider or to provide the service and pay the service provider, we can't easily access that budget that has been approved by Treasury. You remember when Kathy Stoitoya said, Kathy said, this is a red tape. That is the red tape they are talking about. But the red tape of the government wheels that turned slowly has not been removed. Because Treasury would approve, but when the service has been rendered or a rescue has to be given, funds that are there budgeted for approved are not easily released, and we need to find out from Treasury what is it that locks that, what makes it impossible to release the fund. Honorable Honor.
Thanks, Chairperson. My one is a follow-up on this, and then I have a separate question. My follow-up here is, I mean, this is something we've known about a long time. It's not new. Surely, if SAMHSA is struggling, they should go to the DG of Labour or to the Minister or somebody higher up and say, we need an agreement with Treasury that covers how to access the funds, and that Treasury acknowledges that there's a short notice situation here. If the ship crashes tonight, you have to get the tugboat out tonight, and Treasury needs to have some sort of forward cover or something for you so that you can go in and spend the money and get on with it. I mean, surely we don't have to, as a portfolio committee, now tell the department how to suck eggs. I mean, surely the department must go to the DG or to the minister. I mean, the SAMHSA must go to the DG or the minister and say, we need an agreement, a letter, just a one-pager that says, we will only release the funds if you do 1, 2, and 3, and then SAMHSA agrees with the 1, 2, and 3, or they don't agree, but you've got to get an agreement in place, because it's something which is going to happen every other year, and we can't every year have a fight. You know, I mean, Chairperson, surely we need a written agreement. This is how we'll pay the money, this is when we will pay the money, and this is what you're allowed to spend and not allowed to spend when there's an emergency. So that it's like a fire plan, you know. When the fire happens, you don't argue with the fireman as to whether or not he's allowed in your house. He knows what the rules are. He can break my door down and he can come into my house because there's a fire. It's the same situation. It's an emergency. You don't have to run around asking permission. There must be an agreement in place that says when there's a ship crash, 1, 2, and 3 must kick in automatically, and the department has the right to order the tow, the tug, order the whatever, I don't know, whatever is required. So I would just encourage the SAMHSA to go to the DG of Transport or to the Minister and ask for between SAMHSA, the department and Treasury about emergencies. The fund is there. So it's obviously that it's a question of trust, you know. They don't want to give the money over until you can provide this invoice and that document. Well, there must be it's an emergency. It's not normal business. And there must be an agreement. My second question is totally different. I'll just put it quickly while I have the floor, and then I'm done, and that is about air safety. You've got a page 4 here, a statement that this bill is to compel license holders of aerodromes, airfields, heliports, and helistops to file emergency plans with the Rescue Coordination Center, and we support that. It must be done. But I'm just asking a little further. What about their travel, tabling their flight plan? When you have a situation with multiple airfields in one city or one area, is there proper legislation in place to coordinate flight plans between the various airports and airfields? So if there's an airfield at Cape Town International, or close to Cape Town International, how do we make sure that civil aviation and the navigation services and everybody knows about the flight plans of each other, so that you don't have a little plane from some little airfield in the Cape flying across the flight path of a Boeing landing from London? Is the legislation in place to prevent that sort of conflict or catastrophe from these small fields? You've mentioned that you need to compel them to file emergency plans, but does the legislation compel them to file flight plans in advance? Because we hear rumours of possible accidents that might occur in the future because these little airfields seem to not tell us what they're doing, and a plane takes off and then they fly across the 747's flight path. And while we're doing this legislation, Chairperson, I thought I should just ask the question here, because we could change this law now before we sign it into being to make provision for that potential disaster. But the department might be able to tell us that they already have the legislation for that. I don't know. Could they tell us that also?
Thank you, Chair. I'm covered. In fact, he has asked more than I was going to ask. Thank you.
Honourable Chairman.
Chair, I am in this red tape between the department, SAMHSA, and the invoices. It doesn't seem to me that there has been some discussions on how this red tape between Treasury and the department could be avoided. And we should have had something indicating to us this is the decision that was taken between the Treasury and us as a department about that. I will take the chair.
Yeah, I also want to add on that one. It is unfortunate that when we identify a gap between the department and the entity, and the support that we think as a portfolio committee should be given by the department to the agents of the entity, we are misunderstood. And SMSs are being sent once more in the meeting to the DDG, communicating something totally contrary to what we are saying here. Last time we raised the issue of the support of the department to the entities, which is a fair observation. happened was that officials that were here sent SMSs to the DTGs that were not here. And in the night, I received phone calls that were questioning what we were saying in the portfolio committee. This is one area of a gap between an entity and the department. And if we are misunderstood, it is better for people to ask the point of clarity than to send SMSs that are communicating something that is contrary to what we were saying. Also, when we have not asked those people to do so. Because it then tells that those that are here representing the department are not understanding what we are saying and are misinterpreting what we are saying, and as a result, there will be no movement in terms of resolving the problem. What we are identifying here is that there has been this problem, there is this problem. And we see it as a responsibility of the department to intervene. Because SAMHSA is an entity of the Department of Transport. And if there is a hindering factor that prevents SAMHSA from doing its work, it is the department and the minister that has to unlock that and talk to the treasurer. And we are saying again in this meeting, we are putting that in the court of the department to find a solution to that issue so that in future we don't experience that situation as a country where a service will be needed, service providers would need to be secured, but then the payment for that would not be easily made available. When the minute that happens, it becomes the responsibility of the department to resolve that issue. No one else. No one else. We are not then asking a question. We are saying the department should find a solution to that. We are not asking a question. We have identified the problem that the department has not intervened on that issue. You can respond to other questions.
Thanks, Chairperson, and to honourable members. First, let me tackle the question on air safety. Any aircraft that flies through a controlled airspace has to file a flight plan, and that is within our civil aviation regulations. Any aircraft, whether it is domestic or international, that came to Cairo or to Johannesburg, anything that is in the flight in the controlled airspace has to file a flight plan. It's only those small aerodromes where I fly with my Cessna Baron to go and visit my neighbor next door. I'm not flying to a control airspace, so there is no flight plan needed. But as soon as I get into the control flight plan, control airspace, that's where I need a flight plan. And of course, that facilitates issues like the performance-based navigation to prevent these airborne collisions. So at least to answer that question is that all aircraft in controlled airspace have to file a flight plan, and that is part of the act. It is part of the act. With the subject matter, Honourable Chair. Thanks.
So, in other words, you are saying to us, even though there are many smaller flights that are flying in the space, all of those would fly because they've been allocated time to fly and space to fly. So there should be no fear in terms of a possible accident.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable, are you satisfied with the
answer? Chairperson, I think, you know, we're going to have a special meeting, so I won't bog it down now, but there are some questions being raised out there among experts about the space becoming congested. One particular spot where the concerns have been raised with us is around Lanseria. Lanseria itself is behaving, and our Tambo is behaving, but there are lots of little airfields where small planes take off. And the question then comes as a response to your statement is, what is the controlled airspace there? Because, see, if you're not in the controlled airspace, you don't have to file a flight plan. So maybe what those little airfields understand as controlled airspace and what our Tambo and Lanseria understands as controlled airspace might be debatable. Because there are some concerns that we're not going to table them today, because the chairperson has kindly agreed that we will have a discussion at an appropriate time. But if you tell me that the legislation says in controlled airspace you have to file a flight plan, it might be that it's an administrative problem, that the law is there but the people are not behaving. You know, they don't file their plan on time or something. Or it might be that the uncontrolled airspace is where the problems are occurring, because you take off, let's say, from somewhere in Randburg and you fly to Pretoria. It might not be controlled airspace that you're flying in, because it's not the specific airspace that our Tambo is controlling, but you still might cause a problem if you are close by. I don't know, I'm not an air expert, so I don't want to cross-question and argue about it now. I think we should have the experts in the room, and then we can get them to table their concerns. But the chairperson has already a process underway, so I don't want to undermine that process. I think it will be a good process, and we'll properly deal with it. I just wanted to check that the legislation requires, because if the legislation requires, then our questions will be about implementation, not about this piece of legislation. But if the legislation doesn't require, then I was going to say we should amend this one in front of us to cater for that, so that we can force those small airfields to behave before we have an accident. Thanks.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. I am very pleased that the members mentioned this. I think we will need to be briefing the portfolio committee at some stage about air transport and civil aviation matters, more especially what you're raising on the airspace. We've got what we call a saturated area, which is our Tambo, Rand Airport, Grand Airport, and Ivory, which is the new airport coming. We are working on what we call slot allocation in terms of utilization of that airspace. We're working on what is called, as I said, the PBN, which is the performance-based navigation. So I think all members, I'll look forward to being able to brief the committee in detail on what is taking place on air transport and civil aviation matters, and including, of course, the National Airport Development Plan that is currently underway. Coming back to the subject matter of today, Honorable Chair, there are three things that take place in the waters, especially pertaining to the subject matter of today. There's what we call search and rescue, and there's the other element that is called salvage. So the search and rescue, it is the rescuing of lives at sea and not the salvaging. And South Africa is the member of the SOLAS Convention under the IMO, and we comply to that. And the 10 MOUs that South Africa has signed with the 10 SADC countries is primarily on the search and rescue. So this bill that we are presenting to you, Honourable Chair, is basically only on the search and rescue. I think the questions that have come through as a result of salvage, we will take them on board. I've noted them, and we will be engaging to say it on the way forward, especially on the salvage costs, because we do know salvage costs can be very astronomical. But at this stage, I think what we are presenting to you, Honourable Chair, it is the bill that addresses just primarily life at sea, which we call SOLAS, and which is the search and the rescue purposes. Sikhipha abantu and sibayisa ukuthi babe safe. Abaphansi nabo sibakhuphe ukuthi bayongcwatshwa. Thank you. So it is searching for them and rescuing them. And then there is a process that is called salvage. So this is the passion that includes treasure and all those things. I presented this to you, Madam Chair.
No comment. No comment, Chairperson. We have read the bill and we are in agreement with the department.
Technically,
yes, we attended to technical issues and everything, and we certified the bill. We are pleased with the bill on our side, as state lawyers.
We don't want to approve a bill and then we must, as we advise the guy, we first get this Maraca is fine. Okay, thank you.
Chairperson, after all the explanation and the presentation that has been put before you, we are on your hands because our major request is after you have considered the bill and been satisfied, then the committee will request your approval of this bill for further processing for its approval. Thank you.
Can we have the presentation after the second bill?
Are we done with the first one? Thanks, Chairperson. Our second bill that we are presenting before the Portfolio Committee is Transport Laws and Related Matters Amendment Bill 2012, Section 75 Bill. The background of the bill was as follows. So South African National Road Agency Limited, SANRA, was established in terms of the South African National Road Agency Limited and National Roads Act of 1998 and 7 of 98. The SANRA Act provides for the establishment of SANRA to manage and control the Republic's national road system and take charge of the development, maintenance and rehabilitation of national roads within the framework of government policy. The bill has been necessitated by the development of Gauteng Freeway Improvement Project, GFIP, as well as future plans for the development of road infrastructure in the Republic. Apart from the fiscal infrastructure, the GFIP will result in the operation of a road network that involves the utilization of intelligent transport systems. An important component of the network is the electronic toll collection. The bill is essential to enable the appropriate implementation of the electronic toll system. When the Act was promulgated, the electronic toll collection was not envisaged in its current form. The Act is not broad enough to cater for some aspect of the electronic toll collection. The bill will facilitate the collection of tolls and the implementation of the electronic toll collection system. These measures are essential to implement the GFIP, e.g. to upgrade transport infrastructure and public transport in the Gauteng province and beyond, as well as other proposed projects. The bill seeks to provide more effectively for the collection of toll, to amend the Cross-Border Road Transport Act 98 to empower cross-border road transport agents to collect toll on behalf of SANRA, to amend the SANRA Act by inserting a definition, to further provide for the differentiation in respect of the amount of toll that may be levied, to provide that the regulation made by the Minister must be published by notice in the Gazette, to provide for the Minister to make regulations relating to specified toll-related matters, to provide for the Minister to publish draft regulation in the Gazette calling for public comments, to provide for certain presumptions relating to the driving, operation and use of vehicle on a toll road, and the use of electronic evidence to prove an alleged contravention of the SANRA Act, to exclude the levying of toll and collection of toll from the ambit of the National Trade Act 205, and to amend the contents of the SANRA Act and to provide for matters connected therewith. Those were the objects of the bill. I will discuss the bill clause by clause. Clause 1 seeks to amend Section 4 of the Cross-Border Road Transport Act by empowering the cross-border road transport agents to collect toll on behalf of SANRA. Clause 2 seeks to insert the definition of an owner in order for the owner of a vehicle to be responsible for the payment of toll. If I'm to expand on Clause 2, the reason why we have defined this owner in relation to the Road Traffic Act or the National Road Certificate is that in case you have borrowed some wood or you have leased a vehicle from the rental company, because we wouldn't know as to who was driving that particular vehicle. Therefore, the presumption is that the owner, the registered owner of that vehicle, is the one who passed through that particular gantry. And it's upon the owner to say, no, this vehicle was leased to Masumbuza. Therefore, if there is a contravention, then they must take that ticket or inform the issuing authority so that the issuing authority can direct that ticket to the person who was driving at the time, because the owner shall have informed us as to who was driving the said vehicle. That is practically happening in terms of the National Road Traffic Act and the contraventions in terms of contravention of the Road Traffic Act. If you get a ticket, either you are the driver of that vehicle or not, the ticket will go to the owner. And then the owner, it's upon the owner to say this vehicle was driven by so and so, and then you provide the address and they redirect the ticket to the person who was driving. Alternatively, the owner must pay that particular ticket. It's practically working smooth now. That is why we have defined this particular wage in relation to Road Traffic Act. Clause 3 seeks to amend Section 27.3B of SANRA Act provides a means of differentiating the amount of toll payable according to whether the toll is prepaid, depending on the use of an e-tag, some other device as compared with identification through a license number recognition. Clause 4 seeks to provide for the Minister to publish regulation by notice in the Gazette, to provide for the Minister to also make regulation relating to specified toll-related matters, and to provide for the Minister to publish a draft of the proposed regulations in the Gazette calling for public comment. Clause 5 seeks to insert Section 59A(a)(3) in the SANRA Act to provide for a presumption that any electronic evidence must be deemed to be correct in the absence of evidence to the contrary. This aims to facilitate law enforcement and assist in the prosecution of relating to the non-payment of tolls. Clause 6 seeks to amend the heading of Section 6 of the SANRA Act and to provide for the exclusion of the SANRA Act from the ambit of National Trade Act 2005 in amendment of the contents of the Act to reflect the insertion of Section 59A. Clause A provides for the short title and commencement of the Act. Chairperson, our bill is as short as having 8 clauses, and we are to discuss the consultation process on the bill. The draft amendment bill was published in the Gazette in 2008 under Gazette number 3175 on the 19th December 2008 as a single bill. What it means, this particular Gazette number and the bill that was published in terms of this Gazette, it contained issues relating to Section 75 and issues relating to Section 76. On the advice of the State Law Advisor, we were advised that we need to avoid processing a mixed bill. We need to separate the 75 issues and the 76 issues. The current bill that we are presenting before you now is a Section 75 bill. So it has only Section 75 related matters. After our advice, then we realized that now that we have published this bill as a single bill and we are advised to split them into two, then it means that we need to publish again the two separate versions of the bill, the other one having a 75, the other one having a 76. And those 75 and 76 bills were published in two separate gazettes, under Gazette 33027 and Gazette number 33028 on the 15th March 2010. They were published simultaneously. That is why the Gazette numbers are following each other and they were published on the same date. The bill was circulated for inputs to the Shareholders Committee of the Road Traffic Management Corporation. Comments were received from the following institutions: the Public Entity Oversight and Border Control, the South African Chamber of Commerce, South African Tourism Service Association, South African Police Services, the Cross Border Road Transport Agency, the RTMC, the National Treasury. The bill was developed and finalized by the Department of Transport in consultation with the National Treasury. The financial implications. The bill is vitally necessary to enable the collection of tolls for the chief rate. A lack of appropriate legislative authority to collect tolls would place the entire project at risk. The non-collection of tolls may impact negatively on the ability of the other state-owned enterprises to raise capital for their infrastructure programs, and thus the need for the bill must also be seen in the context of government's plan to fund its envisaged infrastructure programs. SANRAL has issued bonds to fund the project of 24 billion, initial capital cost amounting to approximately 20.6 billion plus capitalized interest amounting to approximately 3.4 billion. That needs to be repaid from toll revenue. Failure to collect tolls and repay the bonds would have very serious financial implications for SANRAL and also for the national government, which provided a guarantee in respect of most of the SANRAL bonds. The financial consequence of ineffective collection of tolls to SANRAL and government due to the guarantee would be both reputational and costly. Inability to collect revenue would damage the credit reputation among investors who may price their bonds higher to cover the risk or sell the bonds. This in turn would have a negative impact on both SANRAL and possibly the government's credit ratings. Furthermore, the inability to collect the toll at predicted levels would result in lower revenue available to service debt and force further debts to be incurred to fund the shortfall. This would be costly in terms of interest paid as well as the credit reputational impact explained earlier. The financial implications for the overall project also include future maintenance costs, road rehabilitation and operational costs, servicing of debt interest, and other toll-related costs. Therefore, ineffective toll collection would result in this cost to be funded from other government resources in the future and thereby reducing government's ability to meet its disparate demands. This slide shows the figures and the expenditures related to this particular project. Slide 17, on page 17, the State Law Advisor and the Department of Transport are of the opinion that this bill must be dealt with in accordance with the procedure established by Section 75 of the Constitution, since it contains no provisions to which the procedure set out in Section 74 of the Constitution applies. Furthermore, the State Law Advisor are of the opinion that it is not necessary to refer the bill to the National House of Traditional Leaders in terms of the Section 181A of the Traditional Leadership and Government Framework Act 2003, Act No. 41 of 2003, since it does not contain provisions pertaining to customary law or customs of traditional communities. We have come to the end of our presentation, and we request the Portfolio Committee to consider the bill and further approve the bill for further processing. Thank you.
We'll open for members to comment and ask questions. Narabu on.
Chairperson, thank you. Can I just ask, in terms of deliberations on this bill, are we going to deliberate to the committee later? Because I don't want to complicate this presentation with, I might disagree with a word of a clause here. So can I just understand when you, I must ask the questions of clarity and explanation and all of that today, and then we argue about the clauses in a committee of the committee, a meeting of the committee. Am I right? I don't want to argue about each clause.
We are starting with the questions of clarity.
Okay.
And then after we will be considering the bill and arguing in terms of the clauses and the provisions.
But we're not going to vote today as a committee.
No.
Okay, now then that's fine. Then I can ask just my clarity questions, which will help. Thank you, Chairperson, for that guidance. If I can go to page 7 and ask, what is the motivation for the cross-border transport agency needing to collect money for SANRAL? Because cross-border deals with borders. They don't deal with, there's no border in Gauteng at all. So if you can explain why the cross-border agency must collect money, we need to understand the reason for that. This is the clarity question asking part of this. Okay, and then in terms of clause 4, I noticed that you provide for the minister to publish regulations in the Gazette, but you haven't made provision for this committee to have sight of those regulations. In the National Road Transportation Act, there's a clause which says a copy must be sent to Parliament as well for our input, but here you don't. It's only the minister and only published in the Government Gazette. You don't give us a chance to see those until the process is finished. I wonder if we should consider whether this committee has input, because it's quite controversial. This is not just a normal bill. And then I'm totally confused as to page 10, the two draft bills. You have spoken about two versions of the bill, one which would treat the bill as a Section 75 bill and the other one which would treat the bill as a Section 76 bill, and now I'm confused completely. I'm not confused about understanding what Section 75 and 76 is. I know what that is. What I don't know is why you published two versions of a bill simultaneously and which one we're going to deal with, because it is our view, or my view, let me speak about myself, it is my view that this should be a Section 76 bill for one reason, and only one reason, because I actually agree with the fact that it doesn't affect the House of Traditional Leaders and it doesn't affect those other things. But there's one particular reason why there should be a Section 76 bill, and that is that it affects provinces. If the provincial government of KZN wants to implement a toll road on a regional or provincial road next year, they're going to be governed by this Act as well. So the provincial legislature of KZN should have an opportunity to deliberate the content of this bill. And if you make it a Section 75 bill only, you then cut provincial government of KZN out of the process, and this Parliament will approve this bill without the NCOP, without is going to the provinces, and we will approve it here, which means that the provinces of Gauteng, of KZN, of the Eastern Cape, don't have the opportunity to give input into the bill. So I think it should be a Section 76 bill, but you've confused me, because if you just said it was a Section 75 bill, then I would have had to argue my case and say, well, it should rather be a Section 76 bill. Because now I don't know what to do, because you've published two versions of the bill. So what does that mean? So could you answer both questions? The first one is why you published two versions of it, one Section 75 and one Section 76, And why are you treating it now as a Section 75 bill when the provinces, like my example of KZN, when they want to put up a toll road next year, are they going to be governed by this law? But they don't have a chance to give their input as a provincial government because you cut them out by making it a Section 75 bill. And then in terms of the National Credit Act, you haven't said much about it in your presentation, but you say that the National Credit Act is not applicable. I understand that partially, but there is no provision in this bill to require the department to publish the full tariffs that you're going to be charging the public. But you are repealing the National Credit Act, which is leaving the public a bit vulnerable. On the billboards that exist in Gauteng now, which come about as a result of this Gauteng Freeway Improvement Project, they only publish the e-toll tag rate, which is the discount rate. They are not publishing the expensive rates, which is if you don't buy the e-toll and you get an invoice and you have to go and pay it. That rate's not on the billboard. So it means that that farmer and his wife that we see on TV every other night in that advert that drives into Gauteng, when they look at that billboard and they only come once a year to see their children or something, they don't know how much they're going to pay. And they don't have an e-tag because they're from out of town and they're driving into the system. So you say in the bill, no, we don't want the controls of the National Credit Act. But you don't put requirements in the Act to govern the publishing of the prices and the fees and the tariffs in full. So that Sunrail only publishes the cheap rate, and the person that doesn't come regularly is going to pay a higher rate if they don't have an e-tag, and they don't know that because they don't read the Government Gazette. There should be requirements in this Act to publish all of those prices publicly on the billboard or somewhere so that the motorist who's not from Gauteng knows how much they have to pay before they arrive or when they arrive on the billboard, etc. And then finally, with regard to these, what do you call them? Let me just point it out to you. It's the 559A, the assumptions. Have you thought about what happens with people who have cloned number plates? There are up to 6 vehicles in South Africa with the same number plate. How do you sort that mess out when you hear in the Act make the owner of the vehicle responsible? So you take a photograph of that number plate, there's 6 different vehicles with that number plate, which one is the owner? And you say that in his presumptions, in the absence of evidence to the contrary, it is presumed to be a toll road. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean you're going to presume non-toll roads to be toll roads? Does that mean the motorist has to prove that they weren't on a toll road, that they were on a regular road? I mean, what does that mean? What does that mean that you presume to be on a toll road? I mean, it's not a presumption. If I cross the boom, I'm on a toll road. You don't need to presume anything. Why do you need to presume that I'm on a toll road? Because there's a danger there. You're foreseeing something that we don't know about. And I want to know what you're trying to foresee. Thanks, Jefferson.
Jefferson, thanks. We'll allow Mr. Alex from our agency to deal with the questions pertaining to him. The first one, CBRT should not. Why do you think that they should collect money from the company?
Thank you, Jefferson. That is a long history, and it actually doesn't relate directly to the Gauteng Freeway Improvement Project. And this bill was first compiled in 2008, and that caused rise from a request from the CBRTA and Border Post to also charge vehicles coming into South Africa a similar amount of toll, which is actually the toll for those vehicles to travel through South Africa. And they required to do that, or they wanted to do that, because they want to level the playing field. Our vehicles exiting into other countries must pay huge cross-border levies, and vehicles entering South Africa are presumed to use the toll roads, but then they enter our country and they use all the alternative routes, and there's a lot of failures on the alternative routes, and that is not in line with their delivery, the letter of delivery, which described which route they should use. They approached us, and we've constructed a facility back in 2008-09 at Musina, where there's a center where these vehicles are entering, and then they go through the checking of their vehicle permit as well as roadworthiness and overloading. And the fourth step would be then to charge them their toll for their trip from here, from the border post all the way to Durban or wherever, in advance to ensure that they stick on the roads and that they compensate for the use of roads in South Africa. So this is not directly related to the GFIP. The only thing that comes into play was a question of being asked that we should be able in future also to ensure that people from neighboring countries, if they are operating in an open road environment, that we have the ability to ensure that they also pay their tolls. So that is a further purpose that might arise out of this, but the primary reason for this is, as I've explained, CBRTA request to level the playing field for South African freight companies.
Thanks, Chairperson. Johannes Machat is my name. Regarding the question that Honorable Ollis put on CrossFOB, it's something that we can look into by following the example of the National Road Traffic Act. If it's a proposal that the committee would want to make, that we insert the provision requesting us to submit the regulations to the portfolio committee. Something that we can look into. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will not repeat what has been raised by some members in terms of the concern and the tagging of the bill in relation to the various clauses that have been highlighted. I just want to check for my ignorance the process of consultation, because it seems to me, or is it conventional, not to consult civil society or other stakeholders outside the institutions in terms of this bill? Because I see in your input on page 10, if I'm not mistaken, because the environment from 2010 to 2012 is different, though the substantive issue of the bill remains, but I'm just worried about page 11. You see, I'm looking at those institutions that we have consulted. Has that been canvassed also outside these structures, so that it doesn't come back for us again to say you did not consult broadly enough, other than these ones that are here, because they are organized and most of them are institutions of government. What about the outside stakeholders? Just for my clarity, because 2010 I might have missed quite a lot. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chairperson. If you read properly our slide on consultation, it says we have published this bill in a government gazette for public consultation. And the institutions that are mentioned in this particular slide are those that have come back in writing to us to say this is our comment. But generally, everyone has been consulted as required in terms of the law by means of the gazette. We did not consult by making maybe a national workshop to explain to the parties, but we have not done. But the requirement is that we need to issue the consultation through a gazette, and that is what has been done. This institution mentioned in here, they are the ones who have written back to the department about these are our comments, and we have looked into their comments, and where necessary, we have incorporated those comments into the bill. Thank you. Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I understand what you're saying, and also I did read what I read because I wanted to get that element to say, amongst others, though we did not have responses, because as I'm saying, environment changes from time to time with the social movement. I understand, because if there was an example, you know, those stakeholders that are very vocal at times and vociferous, you know, if you are not robust also in the responses, because this will become a public document, and for mischievous people might take that up and rehash or restart, reinvent your debate as if nothing has been happened. So that's why I'm asking this question, just to cover our backs as Parliament, so that we are not seen tomorrow as not having done our homework in terms of the oversight, in as far as consultation is concerned. Now, you mentioned only these that have responded. I would have loved to see a scenario, even one or two of those civil society or other stakeholders to say, no, we did not receive these responses, but we did. But nevertheless, I accept the explanation. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chairperson. What I want to emphasize on the answer that was given pertaining to CBRC collecting on behalf of SANRAL, we say they had to enter into an agreement and see as to how they can work together in terms of collection of that toll. If they don't agree, it still remains the duty of SANRAL to collect toll. So there is a need that they must enter into an agreement, meaning CBRC and SANRAL must come together and come up with an agreement as to how are they going to be working in terms of collection of that toll. So it is not that we are imposing on CBRC. I would like to agree with my colleague that your request, Mr. Oli, is that we should send a copy of the Gazette immediately after we publish for consultation. That is something that we can slot in into the bill, and that shouldn't be a problem. Because it's also happening with regard to National Road Traffic Act regulation. Your next question was, why publish the two versions simultaneously? Advocate Mahat will deal with that one.
Thanks, Advocate. Why the two versions? Allow me to give you this bit of a background. We initially had a single bill that we published for comment, and we got advice from the state legislature that because we have provisions that would make it a mixed bill dealing with both provincial and national, we rather split them up into two, which we subsequently did. Then we had the Section 75 and 76. The Section 75 part of it only dealt, it was initially termed the Transport Laws First General Amendment, and then it became the 75 and 76 was the Transport Laws Second General Amendment, and then we decided not to proceed with the Section 76 bill, and further to that, we toned down the provisions of the Section 75 bill in the light of the legal advice that we got, and further to that, the court challenge that we have. Further to that, I think there's an opinion that the parliamentary legal advisors have written to the committee dealing with that aspect. So I would humbly request that they elaborate further on that point.
Yes, you can come in.
Thank you, Chairperson. The tagging of a bill is basically a checklist that you use the constitution and constitutional case law to decide in which category the bill would fall. And it's obviously not a Section 74 bill or a Section 77 bill, so you then proceed to Section 76 and see what Section 76 says. And I'm just giving a background on how we tag the bill. Over how we advise the tagging mechanism to tag the bill. And Section 76, I don't know if the members have a copy of the Constitution with them, but Section 76(3) of the Constitution says a bill must be dealt with in accordance with the procedure established either by Section 76(1) or Section 76(2) of the Constitution if it falls within a functional area listed in Schedule 4 or provides for legislation envisaged in any other provisions in Section 65(2). Section 163, 182, 195 sub
3 or 4, 196 or 197. The second section of that, that deal with a different section, the bill doesn't deal with any 165, 163, 182, 195, 196 or 197. The bill doesn't deal with any of that. So then we go to the next section, which is section 76.4 of the Constitution, which says that the bill must be dealt with in accordance with the procedure established in subsection 1 if it provides for legislation which A, as envisaged in section 44.2 of the Constitution or 220 sub 3, or as envisaged in terms of chapter 13 of the Constitution. It doesn't deal with any one of those. So you then proceed to the next one. The bill does not provide for any, as I expected, for any of the legislation provided for in the above mentioned section. Now, what one then has to decide is whether the bill falls within any of the functional areas listed in Schedule 4. And this is where you then rely on constitutional case law, because it's very difficult to decide if it neatly fits into one of those categories. So we then have the constitutional case law in the case of Tsongwane to help us or assist the committee or then the joint taking mechanism to decide where the bill fits in. And Tsongwane says very nicely that whether the provisions of a bill in a substantial measure fall within the concurrent provincial legislative competence. So basically what he's saying is if the provisions of the bill, which is before the committee today, fall within a substantial area listed in Schedule 4 to the Constitution, and if in a substantial measure, if the members then turn to Schedule 4 of the Constitution, if the members have the Constitution with them, there's nothing there, and I literally went through each one of the provisions and underlined and removed it from the entire bill and looked at it individually. None of those provisions in the bill deal with any one of the categories listed in Schedule 4 of the Constitution. While the heading or the main title of the bill talks about transport, the actual provisions of the bill does not deal with anything in Schedule 4 and therefore does not make it a Section 76 or rather a Section 75 bill. If I could put it simply, say for example the bill is headed the Regulation of Education Act or bill, and what it says in the provision in the bill says you must only write on white paper. That has got absolutely nothing to do with anything in Schedule 4, and yet the title says education. So that's how you then decide. So I've gone through each one of the provisions, and nothing in the, and I agree with the state law advisor, that none of the provisions contained in the bill deal in a substantial measure as set up by the Constitutional Court in any one of the listed categories listed in Schedule 4 to the Constitution.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. To what has been said by my learned colleague, the Constitutional Court judgment of Tsongwane changed the whole setup regarding the issue of tagging. Now we have to analyze each and every clause if it relates maybe to Section 76 or 75. We are no longer doing the things like the way we used to do them before, you know. We have to analyze each and every clause if it relates to 76 or 75. That's how things are done now. And South Africa is a constitutional state and we have to follow the precedents of the Constitutional Court when we are dealing with these things, you know, of the Constitutional Court judgments.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to add also that because even though the bill is tagged or might be tagged as a Section 75 bill, it does not preclude the committee from then workshopping or consulting with the various provinces or the province that is affected by e-tagging to consult with members in that province. So nothing prevents or precludes the committee from doing that. But the test is not whether it affects the provinces.
The test rather is, which the Constitutional Court has confirmed, is whether the provisions of the bill in a substantial measure fall in any one of the categories is listed in Schedule 4. And the only categories listed in Schedule 4 are public transport and the regulation of traffic. And it does not fall, doesn't fall in any one of those categories.
You know, if anybody in this entire country thinks that this bill doesn't deal with the regulation of traffic, then you need to be smoking something. It deals specifically with the regulation of traffic. It's about the e-toll system, which is regulating the traffic on the highways in Gauteng. In fact, going to exclude some people from using those freeways if they refuse to pay the toll. So it's in fact regulating the use of roads that are public roads. So in fact, I totally disagree with that last statement. It is in fact specifically regulating traffic. But more importantly than this, and this is something the committee must consider, not the state law advisor, the request to build the Gauteng Freeway Improvement came not from the National Department of Transport or from Parliament. It came, in fact, from the Gauteng legislature. The Gauteng government decided way back that they would need to rebuild the roads in Gauteng, and that they would need to fund it somehow, and that they would have to fund it through the e-toll system or some form of toll system. So what has happened is that that has required this legislation to be drafted. That decision back in early 2000s has brought us a whole long journey to the point where we now have this legislation. So I would urge the committee, and this is something we can deliberate outside of today, so I won't speak long about it now. I would urge the committee to send it back to Gauteng and for information to the other provinces, because once it's approved, it's going to govern other provincial requests to build toll roads in their provinces. So that's not a legislative thing, I understand, and I actually agree with the legal advice there that is a matter for the committee to decide. That is not a matter for the legislation. So I agree with that. I don't agree that it doesn't have anything to do with public transport, however. I think a court would find it difficult to say that this entire bill doesn't deal with public transport. That would be absurd. Thank you, Chairman.
On my side, I would want you to unpack slide number 3. That talks about the background that the bill has been necessitated by the development of the Gauteng Freeway Improvement Project, as well as future plans for the development of road infrastructure in the Republic, and relate that to the comments that have been made by Honorable Oli. But I also want to concur with Honorable Oli on that. The JFEP was initiated in 1996, before even the establishment of SANRAL, which then means that it was a provincial initiative which happened prior to the establishment of the entity that had to raise the funds and facilitate the improvement. I'm raising this because of the same issue that has been raised in terms of a 75 or a 76. To get clarity on that.
Mine is a small one, besides the issue that you raised. I think I've missed something. I just want some clarity on page 16, which deals with figures. Can somebody take me through those figures? what they stand for and so on. There was surely there was a reason to put them here, but I'd not get some input on page 16. Thank you, Chair.
And also they are so small. As if the reason behind is for us not to see.
Well, I'll follow the
and you even do not present it this light.
Our policy person will make available the more visible slide on that. Mr. Alex will take us through the notes.
Can you just explain for our own interest so that we can understand the reasoning behind why is this slide, the information in this slide is so small in comparison to other slides?
Maybe Chair, they can simply start with this one so that they respond also, you know, and all others can follow. Thank you.
Chairperson, we're just technically challenged, not that there's anything that you are hiding there. Our apology and we'll send a proper visible slide and we'll attempt to speak to that.
There are two issues that we are raising. We are raising that the font on this slide is too small, as if it is deliberately done that we should not be able to see this figure. That is the first issue. On top of that, you also do not take us through this slide. And you know for the fact that the issue on the the JPEG is on three areas. The first area that is being raised is the area is the lack of proper consultation. The second issue is the issue of the fees. And the third issue is the issue of the system that is being used to collect the fees. And the issue about that system is that also it is not a South African developed system. It is a foreign system. So that is why we have this particular interest as this committee, because at the end of the day it is this committee that has to process this. And it is this committee that has to stand up and debate on this. So it can't be correct that we are not given full information so that when we are processing, we are clear on everything. You can't walk through a slide, especially a slide that has got figures. When there has been so much noise about the e-tolling system, we have to be very, very sensitive. We are public representatives here. Yeah.
Thanks, Chairperson. That was mouthful. I will right away request Mr. Alex to assist us in explaining this particular slide on the field.
Chairperson, the importance of this slide is to explain actually the financial implications, and that although a figure of the 20 billion capital investment in the project is raised, that from a project financing perspective one must have an idea of the overall cost. And I'm using a simplified an example, but project financing is to generate a benefit earlier than what you would have had it if you had to wait for the cash to invest. If we take Eskom, if Eskom is not borrowing the money and we wait for the power station to be constructed, we delay the benefit of having power, the same of each of us buying a house. But when buying that house, there's a total cost involved, the initial capital cost, the maintenance cost, the bond repayment cost, which includes all the interest. So this slide is explaining that, that the GFIP is not only about that initial upfront cost, the money is borrowed, and that is the first capital cost. If I go through that list, that is the 20.6 billion rand. Then there's continuous maintenance.
You see, that is exactly what we mean. That when you don't unpack the information and simplify it for the layman on the ground to understand, then you are causing confusion and you are inviting trouble for yourself. It is better to explain things up front. And it was not going to help for you to know that information when you are not going to be processing this bill. This bill is going to be processed by the portfolio committee, and this bill is going to be passed by parliament. And it is this portfolio committee that has to have a full understanding and be able to stand up and debate issues here, deliberate issues here, and then go and stand in the House to debate. So that is what we are saying is the problem. That yes, you understand, but that information is not good enough if it is understood only by you. It has to be understood by everybody in South Africa, so that we don't find a situation where we are fighting over something that we are not supposed to be fighting.
I agree, Chairperson. I think this is very important for everyone to understand, and it is a challenge to get this whole understanding out there in the public domain, and something which the Interministerial Committee as well as the GCIS is currently focusing on. The second line there is the road maintenance cost. That is over a 24-year period where on a year-to-year basis we need to maintain those roads. And then about every 8 years there's a big action taking place, like a new asphalt overlay, which is quite costly. So that's also factored in the whole project life cycle. The third cost there relates to the violation processing cost. That is an operating expenditure to process violators or potential violators. A big portion of those costs is actually self-funding, because if a person is violating, then there's a higher tariff applicable to that user. I just want to explain that there are, in that mechanism, also discounts made available to the public. So if you get an invoice and you pay within 30 days after the date of the invoice, you can still pay the full toll tariff if you register. So there's ample time for people to get something through the post and to assist them. But I just want to make that point, because we don't want people that are compliant and that are paying to pay a higher toll tariff to subsidize non-payers. Non-payers must subsidize their own cost. The toll-related capital and operating expenditure, that is the cost related to operating the system. Then there are other operational expenses, and that is the cost of lifting up the freeways, quite an expensive cost, and the challenge in terms of vandalism and theft. And then the freeway management system, the intelligent transport system. People traveling Gauteng would have noticed several vehicles that go now with our camera system on the roads. We identify the incidents. We've got every about 10 kilometers vehicles spaced along the network, and they go out directly to that incident to make it safe. The service includes a first-line medical response, people on motorcycles to get to people, to stabilize them until ambulance service arrives. And then we've got towing vehicles. And we believe that is so important in road safety, because a stranded vehicle seems just like an incident, but apart from the decongestion it creates, we've got horrific video material about the secondary accidents it creates, where people drive into the back of the queue and so on. So for us, it's all about that timeline to identify the incident as soon as possible and remove the vehicle. And that is the freeway management system and the ITS. And then, of course, like you're paying on any money that you obtained through issuing of bonds, there's the cost of the borrowing, the interest. And that is making up the total cost there of 71 billion rand. And this cost is also publicly available, and it's also part of the whole court case at the moment, where this is in public papers. So it's not a cost that is actually hidden, but I think it's, as you've said, very important that we explain it also to this portfolio committee. I was also asked just to deal with some of the other questions that were asked. Just on the presumption and the issue of cloned number plates. Cloned number plates is reality already in terms of the National Traffic Act. I almost want to say we don't say, okay, now we're not going to do any law enforcement anymore because of cloned number plates. What we rather are saying is that we know that there is a problem that needs to be addressed, and this system that we are implementing will definitely assist to address that. We have various meetings with the SAPS, incorporating the system with the assistance in SAPS to greatly assist with vehicle crime prevention. Secondly, that is why we encourage people to get a tag. I must state that the tag is for free. You don't buy the tag, so there's no cost related to getting the tag. As soon as you obtain the tag, you get that as a credit on your account. And then, how the system is working is reading your tag, and the tag cannot be cloned. And then the system does a match between the tag and the number. And if there's a mismatch, then that gets reported. Vehicles with a cloned number plate won't be able to get a tag that corresponds to that specific number plate. And the system is such that all the evidence are collected. That is why it's a presumption in court that it's a tolerant, because the evidence will be there, and I mean a video or photographic evidence, and also the minister then gets the regulations to ensure that that technical specifications of how you collect that information, to ensure that if a owner is actually making a nomination or a representation, as is also allowed in terms of argument, to say it wasn't me, that all the information is available, you can actually view that information as a account holder and see all the information itself for every toll transaction. In terms of the toll tariffs, we will publish the toll tariffs for comment. So there will be an option available. Just need to state that there's a practical consideration with the amount of information you can display next to the road. That is also in terms of the number of information a person can physically read, and it's a road safety issue. So one cannot put there as much bits of information. It gets regulated in terms of the South African Road Traffic Signs Manual. The tariffs displayed there at the moment are the ETAP tariffs, because we felt that it's most appropriate to about 99% of the users that will use the freeway network, and given the huge discounts available for people to register an ETAP, that will be the tariff mostly used. The issue of the background, and that
just before we step off this one, we just need a little bit of clarity on the figures once again, because I would assume that your total by the end of the 24th year, you are saying it was initially 89.7 billion, am I right? And then, but above that, your interest on this, that leads to 89.38.331. Then your interest on your revised is 20 billion. I can't get that figure quite. 20 billion. And your revised will be 71.3. Can I just get a little bit of talking around the two figures? Because something is not gelling to me in my mind in what you are raising here. Thanks, Chair.
Chairperson, yes, that is just in to be be open about this whole thing, and there's been such a lot of confusion about this. What happened was that the first expenditure, September 2011, rand value, the original NA1, and it's referred to NA1 because it is presented like that in court papers, that, we sometimes make mistakes, and what happened was it's just a double count in terms of the inflationary effect of money that was built into the interest and incorrectly reflected. We picked that up almost immediately thereafter, and we said to the court, we've made a mistake, we admit that this was a mistake, and here's the corrected one and why the mistake occurred. So it was just in terms of being open about there was a different version that was presented, but it was immediately pulled back, and the different one was then submitted. So maybe it was not the right thing to include for this presentation.
Maybe the problem was I had to pick that up as a layman person, because I would have thought that the department would have been upfront with this matter. I would not like to go through these figures, but surely, for me, there is a challenge. That's why I'm doing this point. And now the department is admitting that officials are saying they should have been open. I'm not sure what that means. Where does this act as a committee? Anyway, I accept the explanation, but it needs a little bit of talking. At some point in time. I'm not sure at what stage, when they need to be very open and transparent.
Yes, I agree with Honorable Suka. To me, it looks like you knew there was a mistake. That is why you didn't read this this whatever it is. And it was just going to pass away. Maybe that is what you wanted. That you mustn't know about your mistake or your corrected mistake, but it is not right. It really is not right. To me, it is more about the accuracy, but at the same time, the quality of work and the respect given to Parliament that Parliament deserves. Because a department can't come to Parliament with an inaccurate information. Parliament is the highest decision-making structure in the country. And anyone who comes to Parliament to present something must check the information before. And if you miss that and you discover when you are here, the best thing to do is to admit first before the members identify that. That gives them the kind of respect and dignity that Parliament deserves. We don't have to fight about these issues. We must accord one another the kind of respect. If you want us to treat you with respect and dignity, give us the same. Members of Parliament are people that are elected by the public out there to represent their interests here and make laws that make the lives of those people easier, comfortable, and we don't have to fight over how we need to treat each other.
My last take. saying that this page would be reworked or revised so that we get more information, or we leave it as it is because, as you said, that we need to be much more wiser on this matter so that you can own up all of us, because our intention is to assist the department and make some interventions where it is necessary when they ask us to do that. But in the manner now, I'm not sure what has been about this page, let alone the figures themselves. Because if you add them also, just roughly, I'm not sure, especially on this, the last one now, the revised figures that they are talking about. Are we going to get more information on this page, or to believe it as it is? Maybe let us put it that way simply.
Thanks, Chairperson. My apology. I would like to assure the committee members that the purpose of having jumped this particular slide, just may have been an oversight on my side. I'm not a finance expert, and I thought maybe after my presentation, then I would request Mr. Alex to explain this particular page. That we have been flooded with other questions before I could request that. But my proposal, in order to make sure that we are transparent to
it would have been much better if when you jumped to this slide, you then indicated that there was going to be an explanation, because we would then have given that opportunity. Or if at the end of your presentation you then said, there is a slide that I missed that I would want the expert on finances to present to the members of the committee, we would have handled this issue differently.
I must accept and apologize, Chairperson, for having committed that particular error. I would propose that on the question of finances, maybe we park the matter on the finances, and then we come and make a thorough presentation on the financial implications of this particular bill, so that all of our data pertaining to this can be understood by every member of this particular committee. It might also be helping if there are other further questions which other members want to raise, then they raise them, so that if we don't have an answer now, on our return, when we are coming purposely to explain the financial implications, we can also clarify those other questions. Thank you, and I apologize.
Are members satisfied and have a clear understanding of the object of the bill?
Chairperson, those objects are quite lengthy and they are very important, but I think I would want to internalize them, especially there are certain clauses. Also, itself, we did raise, I think, clause 3, of paragraph 3, in fact, of those objectives. I would want to just internalize them and come back to you, Chair. That would be my. Because they are quite important and they've got a bearing on what has been raised by Mr. Ollis earlier on and other members. Thank you.
So, members would want to raise this, and then when we deliberate again, we call the department back. Is that what you are saying? Is there anyone who wants any clarity? In terms of its background and in terms of its object, what is it that it seeks to achieve? And any other matter, like all the clauses that we have gone through, from clause 1, what clause 1 is to achieve, what clause 2 is to achieve. Does the Parliamentary Law Advisor want to make any comment?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to conclude by saying that I agree with the department and the state for advisors that it is indeed a Section 75 bill. And I'm more than willing to explain to the members, clause by clause, how we went about in tagging or advising the joint tagging mechanism on the tagging of the bond.
Thank you very much. You will be notified as to when we will be considering the bill, and then and you will be invited to come and be part of that process again, so that you are able to assist in the process. Thanks very much.
Yes, sir. Chairperson, our session resumes. Then we have dealt with, are we going to consider it on the next date, or are you still going to deliver it? Outside while we're waiting for Honorable Masete to get a member to assist us with the quorum, we can grab a cup of tea.